Good afternoon, and thank you for standing by. The call is now being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Ms. Hendricks, you may begin.
Hi, this is Amanda Hendricks, and I'll be the host of the CHARM telecon today. I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Claudia Alexander, who will be giving us the talk today. Claudia is the project manager and the project scientist of the U.S. Rosetta Project, and this is a European Space Agency mission to a comet that has NASA participation. And on Cassini, Dr. Alexander is the magnetospheres discipline scientist. And so today she's going to be talking to us about Saturn's magnetosphere and the measurements that the Cassini spacecraft instruments are making of the magnetosphere of Saturn. So without further ado, we'll go ahead and get started.
Okay, just to let you have an idea of where I'm currently located, I'm in the Netherlands at a Rosetta meeting. We're having our project science group meeting over here for the International Rosetta Mission. So it's about 8 o'clock at night, and I haven't had dinner, but I have to be here with you guys and talk about Saturn's magnetosphere, which is quite exciting to me to be able to not only do comet work with the Rosetta mission, but also to be able to do magnetospheric work, and I did that kind of work with the Galileo mission at Jupiter, and now with the Cassini mission at Saturn. And I came up with what I thought was a very sexy title, you know, and flowing, Saturn's magnetosphere. And as I was working on my talk last week, I was still here in Switzerland, and somebody was looking over my shoulder. It was a guy, and he said, "I couldn't get away with saying something like that." And I thought, oh, yeah, right. But the talk will very quickly become unsexy, I promise. So let's go ahead and dive into, on page 2, I'm going to start talking about the basic elements of the magnetosphere, that there are components that will come up as I am talking throughout the rest of this presentation, and I want you to be aware of what parts we're actually talking about. So in the lovely graphic that you see before you, and we'll go through each of these parts in the next several graphics, but there's a bow shock, and then there's underneath that is a magnetosheath, then there's a magnetopause, and all of these have to do with the fact that the magnetic field of Saturn is sitting in the middle of a streaming solar wind, and the solar wind is approaching from the left. And just like a bow wave in front of a boat, as a boat is moving through the water, there's this wave where the water is forced to go around the boat. And so the magnetosphere of any planet is sort of a hard object, like a boat or a rock. And the streaming solar wind has to go around. And the hardness of the object is relative, and that's a sort of second-order effect, is just how hard is that object. And so a lot of what we're discussing, the bow shock, the magnetosheath, the magnetopause, are all a result of the fact that the magnetosphere of the planet is embedded in another magnetosphere, and there's particles going by, and that confines the magnetosphere into a bubble shape. Now, inside the magnetopause, in particular for this giant planet, we have moons and rings are scattered throughout the magnetosphere. And then we have, normally in a magnetosphere, we'd have a plasma sheet or a plasma disk. And in this case, not only do we have a plasma sheet, but we have a giant neutral cloud, which is this orange thing. And then we have the magnetotail. So we're going to talk about all of those things. And what makes these things exciting to me is the fact that they're all in motion. You know, the planets, Jupiter, its moons, the atmosphere is in motion, but sometimes those motions take decades to, you know, the white ovals and the various things take decades to go away or to complete their circulation. The moons obviously have, most of them have been frozen solid for, you know, billions of years. And so it's in the magnetosphere that you have something that's daily in motion and it changes all the time. And I think that is what makes it one of the most dynamic places in the solar system. Now, on the next page, on page 3, is all of them are going to say Saturn's magnetosphere, but this is an outline of the bow shock, which is the white curve on the very sort of parabolic curve on the leftmost side. And that would be the very first indication, if you're a little charged particle minding your own business going along in the solar wind, the very first indication that you have a magnetosphere ahead of you is the bow shock. And so you cross through the bow shock and you know something is wrong. Okay, something is coming up. And so we go to the next page, and this shows us the solar wind streaming. And as soon as the streamlines enter the bow shock, they are deflected right away. And so you can see that deflection is to a greater or lesser degree depending on how close you are to the center of the bow shock. And we go to the next slide, and this is the magneto sheath is the distance, is the region that's between the bow shock and the actual magnetopause, which is the edge of the magnetic field of the magnetosphere of Saturn. So there's this region that's still filled with solar wind, where the solar wind is going around, and it's almost like if you're in a boat, the magnetopause would be the hull of the boat, and the magnetosphere would be the boat itself, and the magnetosheath would be this range of water that's going around. Okay, so that's what the magnetosheath is.
And then on
the next,
Claudia.
Yes.
Once the solar wind particles cross the bow shock, then their properties change somehow.
They are slowed down, and they are called shocked solar wind. Okay, it's gone through the bow shock. And now it's slowing down, and it knows that there's a magnetosphere present, and then there's going to be a circulation pattern that comes in. And we'll talk about the circulation pattern and what happens to those charged particles a little bit later in the talk. So just a few more words in the lexicon that we use to describe this environment. So the pink line that you see on figure 6 is the magnetopause shape itself. And then some of the moons are shown on the next slide. Excuse me. And then we have this enormous neutral cloud, which is a unique feature of Saturn alone. The other magnetospheres don't have this gigantic neutral cloud. They have instead a thick plasma sheet that doesn't flare out like this, like the neutral cloud does. And lastly, we have this on the right-hand side of the magnetosphere, on the opposite end of the sun-facing side, is the magnetotail of the planet. And so we'll talk about that magnetotail at length a little bit later in the program. So before I go on, are there any questions about just those terms that we walked through? Okay, so it's important to remember that what I just walked through is a series of just pictures that an artist has put together to illustrate what is this big structure that's out in the near Saturn. And what we're doing with the Cassini spacecraft and with the instruments is we're going to use the actual measurements to map out this region and to build the picture of it in our minds based on what the data is telling us it actually looks like. And I often create an allegory when I'm talking about this. It's the spacecraft and its instruments are very much like our five senses. And typically, you know, we typically use the camera as our eyes. And you can look at an image of a moon surface and you go, oh yeah, I know what I'm looking at. It's a crater or whatever it is. It's a lake, or I think it's whatever. We have the ability to translate that data automatically, mentally, with our brain. But with the fields and particles instruments, we're largely sensing something that's invisible, and we're using our different senses. So we're using more tactile senses, the feeling, our ability to feel, and some of the instruments are very much like a mouth or a nose. And, for example, the particle instruments, a lot of them have an aperture and stuff goes in. And it's almost like you have a taste. They do a composition experiment with the particles going into the aperture, And they say, okay, that was oxygen. So it's almost like having a mouth and going, yeah, okay, I know what that was. And then the mouth is spinning around, okay? So the aperture, in order to sample in 360 degrees or maybe 4 pi steradians, which is like a big sphere, this aperture will be spun around. And then they'll have to, maybe it takes 4 minutes to complete one spin. And so in the 4 minutes, let's say it looks in 360 degrees in sections, right? Let's say it does it in 8 sections. And so if there's a streaming of particles coming from one direction, it can tell. It's like, oh, I felt something there. You know, there was a fire hose of stuff coming at me from that one direction. And every 4 minutes when I turn around, I feel something coming from that direction. So the particles instruments are like our sense of touch and taste in some regard, or even smell. And then the RPWS instrument, I like to think of, and I know the PI can't stand it when I when I do this, but I like to think of it as the spacecraft's ears. And the reason why that is it's a hard analogy to make is because sound doesn't travel in space. So sound waves are not possible in space, and so to actually think of what the PWS instrument picks up as sound is not correct. But space is made of an electromagnetic medium, and when that electromagnetic medium oscillates, it creates radio waves that the instrument does pick up, and those radio waves can be translated into audio frequencies, and so they're often able to create frequency translations of the sounds of the magnetosphere. And I like to think of that instrument as being able to pick up the sounds of things happening in the magnetosphere. So if we go to slide 11, these are some of the schematics of the instruments. We have the MIMI instrument on the left-hand side, which has two sensors, a LEMS and a CHEM sensor, and a third sensor is called the INCA, which I'll talk about in a moment. And I just did a little, instead of putting the actual instrument diagram on the slide, I just showed a little diagram of a dipolar magnetic field. excuse me. In space, a magnetic field is not a simple dipole as shown in this diagram, and the magnetometer is capable of detecting the components of the magnetic field, the X, Y, and Z components. It's a vector quantity that allows us to tell what direction that magnetic force is directed in, and we can map out the field lines and also detect the perturbations that are part of what's happening as this whole structure is in motion. And we're trying to figure out what's causing the motion and what are the circulation patterns. And then the next on the right, the lower right, is just a diagram of the CAPS instrument. So let's go to the next slide 12. And I just did a really rudimentary discussion of what these instruments have done. And rather than read it to you, I'm going to talk it through more in terms of how I think of the instruments. And the CAPS is just like the instrument I just described, which is like a mouth, you know, where it's an aperture and things go in. And based on things going in, it can determine the velocity at which particles are coming. It can tell the temperature. It can distinguish various kinds of ions, electrons, and it can tell the density of the bulk flow density. Was there a question? I thought I heard a noise out there. Okay. The next slide is the MIMI instrument. And I mentioned before that there were three sensors, the CHEMS, the LEMS, and the INCA. Again, the MIMI is very similar to the CAPS instrument in that it has an aperture, but it basically detects a different energy range of particles than the CAPS does. And you need different kinds of sensors to pick up in this environment that you can't see. You're going to be bombarded with particles of various energy ranges, and there's not yet been an instrument built that can sense the complete range of energies. And so the CAPS is able to detect the bulk, the main part of the energetic spectrum, and then the MIMI instrument detects a higher energy and lower energies, and the INCA sensor is something that actually images the neutrals in the magnetosphere. So that sensor is got a lot of different kinds of capabilities on it. The next slide shows the RPWS.
Can we go back to 13 real quick?
Yes.
Yeah, on 13, just to clarify, is this
plot? Is this image showing us the range of energies that MIMI detects?
Actually, this is a plot that gives an example of the capability of the instrument.
Okay.
This is a plot with the big black cutout in the middle. That's the neutral cloud. And so this is it. We'll talk about this a little bit later in the presentation, but there's a Saturn range that is depicted in this plot, and there's energetic detections going on the right side and on the left side, and in the middle there's no detections going on, and that's telling the instrument team that there's a big absorption happening, and it's the neutral cloud that's absorbing particles. And so this big cutout area is, it's like proof that there's a cloud out there.
Okay, so now I see, though, when I look further, that this is just for the range of, like, 0 to 3 kNG, and then so there might be another plot for the other range.
Right, this is actually MeV.
Oh,
okay.
Oh, I can't. Okay.
Right, so these are very energetic particles. And the more lower normal energy particles are picked up by the CAPS instrument.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. And then on page 15, just going over again the fact that we have a magnetometer, and I'm just going to go over the four instruments that are key to the fields and particles, the kinds of measurements that help us build the picture of what the magnetosphere really looks like. And so the magnetometer is one of those key instruments that it turns out that in order to derive some of the properties of the magnetosphere, you have to know what the particles are doing, and you have to know what the magnetic field is doing at the same time. And you do the calculations, and you have to know those two things so that the magnetometer's observations by themselves are not enough to help you describe the environment, and neither is the plasma. Sometimes some of the diagnostic tools require knowledge of the magnetometer, the magnetic field, and the plasma particles. And so that's why one of the reasons why the magnetometer measurements are so important, aside from just telling us what the magnetic field configuration is at any given time. You can see in this little diagram that's included on this slide, there's a lot of structure, so that when I put the simple picture of the dipolar magnetic field, which is just simple, almost elliptical lines going around, when you get there and you start measuring the magnetic field, it's bouncing all over the place. There's all this structure. It's going, the directions are changing back and forth rapidly. And it's by studying the rapid changes in the magnetic field direction, you're understanding what currents are present, you're understanding what impulses and forces are being impinged on the magnetic field itself. And so there's quite a lot that has to be done in terms of studying even the three vector components of the magnetic field in terms of understanding what's going on. I might point out that not only does the magnetometer sense the direction of the magnetic field, but it can also sense very long wave pulses that go through the magnetic field. So in that respect, it's sort of like it picks up low frequencies. The RPWS will pick up a large range of frequencies. But the magnetometer can pick up the very long wavelength perturbations, almost like in an orchestra, you have the bass that picks that it has the lowest wavelengths, and the magnetometer covers that. So on page 16, I want to start now to talk about what do the measurements of these instruments tell us about what the morphology of the magnetic field is. And the first thing that was discovered about Saturn, if we look at the diagram on the right, and it's got that pink line, which is the magnetopause, one of the things that they wanted to learn was, is there a current disk in the front on the day side of Saturn's magnetosphere that helps to tell us something about how plasma is stored in the magnetosphere and what kind of circulation pattern is going on inside. And they took the shape of that pink line was used to derive an understanding of whether or not there was actually a current disk. And not only did they decide that, yes, there is a current disk present, but the current disk seems to be bowed like a bowl. And that's one of the first discoveries or that helps us give us an idea of the shape of what's happening at Saturn. So whereas with Jupiter, it was a sort of a long, narrow magnetosphere on the day side. On Saturn, we seem to have this bow shape, which is it's very interesting.
So that
phenomena.
So Claudia,
yes?
That purple line or pink line, that is the shape for Saturn. But if you drew it for Jupiter, it would be different.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
So there's two issues. One is that the pink line is a unique shape for Saturn that is dependent upon how much plasma is actually there being stored at Saturn. And at Jupiter, there's so much plasma, and the magnetic field is got a certain configuration. And the at the equator, the pink thing really really shoots out. So it's bullet-shaped at Jupiter. And at Saturn, it's not bullet-shaped like that.
And is that...
Go ahead.
Because of the neutral flow?
I think that we don't know. We're still answering these questions for ourselves. Okay. I would say yes because of the neutral cloud, but there's also some issues about the actual magnetic moments of the interior of Saturn that give rise to the dipole, the quadrupole, and the octopole moments, and how those balance out against each other. We happen to know that at Jupiter, the quadrupole moments are very strong, and that means that there's the ability for the magnetosphere shape to be bullet-shaped. And I think we don't know those answers quite yet for Saturn. We do, one of the extended mission things, instrument objectives, was to go and study more about the internal magnetic field of Saturn to try and understand how it's structured, how strong some of those magnetic moments are. Okay. So another thing that has been discovered about Saturn is that there are indeed current sheets in the day side of the magnetodisc. And so it is formally a magnetodisc with currents, even though the current is only one-tenth of the huge Jovian current disk. And so they were able to understand that at Saturn, it's dipolar out to about 4 RS, that's the shape of it, and then it's quasi-dipolar from 4 RS to 16 RS, and then it becomes a magnetodisc from 16 RS on out. And so we have this bowed shape on the bottom left. We've got this bow shape, and then it starts to... there's this sort of fuzzy gray line where the magnetodisc starts to take over. And I wanted to also compare that with Jupiter, and we're going to go back and forth between Jupiter and Saturn throughout this talk and the Earth, because at Jupiter and on the right, we have, now we're looking down on the top.
This is 18?
On page 18.
Okay.
And the bow shock, and the magnetopause is this dotted line that is a sort of a hyperbolic dotted line around the front, and then there's a dashed circular line in the middle, and Jupiter is a tiny dot at the center of that circle. But the arrows going around there are the magnetodisc of Jupiter, which has just got an enormous current. I even liken it, I'll do my little music, you know, I have my Earth, which is the Pastorale by Beethoven. Da 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 da. And Jupiter, you know, is that da 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 da. So we've got this powerful magneto disc stirring around at Jupiter. And Saturn is somewhere in between. Okay? It definitely has a magneto disc. It's not as powerful of a current as Jupiter. And we will revisit that figure that's on the right side again. Okay, so now we're going to go to page 19. And just for comparison purposes, Earth does also have a magnetospheric current system. And instead of a current disk, Earth has what's called a ring current. It's very much less powerful than either Saturn or Jupiter. There are currents that go across the magnetopause, and there are currents that go across the tail, and then there's a cross-tail current in the middle of the plasma sheet. And this is a cutaway. You can sort of see out several RE, radius of the Earth downstream, you'll see this plasma sheet coming into play. And so at Saturn, we have a current sheet, so it's a more powerful place to store plasma. So let's go on. Yes. Hello? Was there a question? Okay.
Oh, Claudia, hi. David Del Monte here again. While you're open to question, on the magnetosphere from Jupiter, how far towards Mars and Earth does that extend? Does it impact us at all?
Oh, absolutely not. No. It's important to know that on the day side, the magnetosphere is foreshortened, but the magneto tail on the opposite, you know, the anti-sun direction, can be quite long indeed. So that Jupiter's magneto tail extends to the orbit of Saturn.
Wow.
And we're not exactly sure how far the magneto tail of Saturn extends. And the magneto tail of the Earth extends quite far indeed, like 500 RE downstream from the Earth. But on the day side, it's not nearly as far. So I think the magnetopause on the day side is like 100 RJ, I believe, and don't quote me, but it's a lot shorter than the magneto tail is. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Okay. Now, the next part of painting the picture and really creating a picture with data instead of just with an artist's imagination is to actually now go to the magneto tail and ask ourselves, how is that tail formed and what does it look like for Saturn? And so before we get to this question of what does it look like for Saturn, we're going to talk about how do you actually form the magneto tail. And I'm going to back up a little bit. On page 21, I'm going to talk a little bit about the solar wind again and what kind of pressure that creates and how we get a circulation pattern inside of the magnetosphere based on solar wind pressure. So this lovely green ball is the sun, and actually this I didn't clip in the movie of the sun going around, but I'm sure you've all seen these chromospheric movies of the sun where you have bright spots that glow because they're sampling down further down into the sun's plasma. And you've got stuff streaming out of the sun constantly to a greater or lesser degree. High-speed streams, energetic streams, low-speed streams, and so forth. And so at Earth, we have what we call space weather, which is us you know, on any given moment, being able to say, okay, today is a quiet day or an active day or a disturbed day in the solar wind. And we have various ways of measuring the solar wind pressure that impinges on the Earth's magnetic field. And so one of the things that happens with the Earth is that the magnetic field itself will peel off. You add flux on the day side, and the magnetic field peels off and goes over the pole and reconnects on the night side. So you'll have, in this diagram, page 22, there's a red arrow, and it says flux is added on the day side, and then it pulls over the poles and it reconnects on the night. And that takes a lot longer than the actual rotation time of the planet. So one of the things that the magnetospheric scientists have been asking themselves in the past year is, does Saturn have a magnetotail? And one of the things I wanted to point out with this diagram is that an empty cavity, if you just had magnetic flux and you didn't have any plasma or current back there, that would not constitute a magnetotail. So magnetospheric scientists are saying, okay, do we have one or not? So we're going to be looking for what is that cavity filled with and are there currents present. So back at the Earth, because we know what happens at the Earth, so then we're going to be looking for what happens at Saturn. Okay, we have a circulation pattern that is called basically the Dungey model of circulation at the Earth's magnetosphere. And so the solar wind impinges from the left on the day side of the Earth, on the magnetosphere, and the flux is pulled over the tail, and it reconnects in the back, and it forms an X line. So at spot number 6, in the back of this magnetotail, is you'll see that shape, an X shape, and that's called the X line that's formed. And we'll go to the next slide in a second. That X line moves in response to the solar wind pressure. I had the stoplight chart on an earlier slide, and it said active, quiet, disturbed. And depending on whether it's active, quiet, or disturbed, this X line, number 6 in this slide, goes backwards and forwards, closer to the Earth or farther from the Earth.
So the X line at 6 is not the close of the tail. The close of the tail is somewhere off to the right. We can't see it?
That's correct.
Okay.
And sometimes the tail even extends to the Earth's moon.
Okay.
But just to give you a flavor of how enormous Saturn and Jupiter's magnetospheres are, is the moon is completely enclosed in Jupiter and Saturn's magnetosphere, whereas with the Earth, sometimes the magnetotail extends to the Earth's moon, and sometimes it doesn't, depending on the strength of the solar wind. So we're going to go. We have a sort of pastoral Earth discussion where we don't have the kind of powerful currents that we have at Jupiter and at the giant planets. And now I'm going to talk about what we think happens at the giant planets. Okay, and you'll notice that this cavity of the magnetic field has this gray stuff in the middle, and this is plasma. And at Jupiter, we have this enormous, powerful current disk, magneto disk. And in this picture, we're looking from the side, and so we would be looking edge-on to the magneto disk. And you can see that in this picture, the magneto disk is also in the tail, and you'll see this arrow where plasma is going down the tail. And so there's an ejection of plasma down the tail with the giant planets. So let's now go to page 25. So what constitutes a magnetotail? An asymmetrical cavity is not a magnetotail. A magnetotail has a current in the middle, and at Earth, we know that it's formed from the solar wind interaction, this Dungey-style circulation. But at Jupiter, we know that what's more important at Jupiter is the presence of the current disk and the fact that plasma is flowing downstream. And that's called a planetary wind. And we know that plasma is loaded into Jupiter's magnetosphere from the volcanic moon Io. So then we have, and I still want to do a little bit more background before we turn to what happens at Saturn. I mentioned that the X line goes back and forth, depending on whether the solar wind conditions are active, disturbed, or quiet. And when the solar wind is connected to the Earth, and the solar wind particles, somebody at the beginning of this talk asked me, what happens to those charged particles of the solar wind when they get past the bow shock? During times when the solar wind is connected to the Earth's magnetosphere, the IMF is connected, then the plasma particles themselves circulate in and become trapped into the Earth's magnetic field. And ultimately, they get deposited in the auroral zone. Okay? So we have, and this is called a substorm. So we have storms that take place on regular intervals in the Earth's magnetic field. And what happens is that the magnetotail, the X line, gets stretched out. It stretches towards the moon. Okay? And then as plasma gets loaded in to the tail, that there's a near-Earth neutral line, another X line will form, and then that X line moves towards the tail, and this between the two X lines is a completely self-enclosed blob of plasma called a plasmoid. I know that's a funny term. And the plasmoid goes shooting off towards the moon, and the X line goes shooting off towards the Earth. And that ends up dumping a lot of particles. Ultimately, the particles go into the poles of the Earth along the magnetic field line, and they end up forming the aurora. So a lot of charged particles end up being deposited in Earth's upper atmosphere and give us the light. Okay, that's the energy coming from this whole process. So if we go to page 27... we had at Jupiter an interesting combination of the Dungey-style interaction, which is when the solar wind gets connected to the planet, you have this circulation pattern that I just described, coupled with this planetary wind where the planet was, where the plasma is shooting off down the tail. And one of our investigators named Vitenis Vasilounis came up with a scheme to describe how this works. And here we revisited this picture that we've looked at before, and there's 1, 2, 3, and 4 locations in the magnetosphere. And so if we think of the sun over on the left-hand side, and so, and let me see if I get this right, I probably will get it wrong, but dawn would be up and dusk would be at the bottom, and midnight would be in the anti-sun direction. And so point number one is towards the dusk side of the magnetosphere, and point number four is towards the dawn side of the magnetosphere. And what Professor Vasilounis noticed was that in the dawn side, near number four, you have this Dungey-style X line that forms, where the magnetic field pinches off and you form these plasmoids that go shooting down towards Saturn. But over on the dusk side, you have just plasma shredding. Okay, so if you have this arrows going around Jupiter in this circular pattern, that's the current disk going around and around and around. But on the dusk side, it shreds and the plasma comes piling off. And so we call this a region where the magnetic disk is shredding. And we, as we went around with the Galileo mission in the Jupiter's magnetosphere, we noticed these episodes of shredding. And we would very much like to know what's going on with Saturn. I might mention that there's more than one way for plasma to go shooting off down the tail, and one of them is what we call a flux tube interchange mechanism, where heavy plasma that got heavy because a moon, let's say, unloaded some plasma, let's say Enceladus, or let's say Io, in the case of Jupiter, unloads a bunch of plasma, and then we have a loaded flux tube will actually change places with one that's less loaded. And then on page 28, in the final diagram on the right, you'll see flux tube A, which used to be close to the planet, is loaded down with plasma, and it's moving out. Okay, so this is something we noticed happening with Jupiter, flux-tomb interchange, moving plasma downstream.
And so when the plasma actually gets shredded away, then it's lost completely and it moves and it leaves the magnetosphere completely? Eventually?
Yes, the plasmoids that are these self-contained bits of plasma, those go shooting off and they are lost from the magnetosphere completely. Or you might think of them as being returned to the solar wind, because some of them are solar wind particles that got sucked into the magnetosphere and are circulating around. And it's also a way for the magnetosphere to shed itself of excess plasma that it can no longer hold. But for the most part, there's a circulation pattern where the plasma is going around like a stream, you know, like the atmosphere, where the atmospheric cloud particles are going around and various storms are happening. In the magnetosphere, we have a very similar analog where we have circulation pattern going around, storms happening, and stuff eventually being lost either down to the planet through the ionosphere and creating aurora, or downstream in the form of a plasmoid that gets ejected from the magnetosphere. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I wanted to point out on slide 28 that we did notice one of these interchange mechanisms happening near Dione, which is an interesting phenomenon. We don't have all the answers yet, but we're certainly making note of the interesting phenomena that we are discovering.
And which instrument then was it that measured that? Or was it all?
I should have. This would be a combination of both plasma and magnetometer data that would have made an found that kind of a phenomena.
So it would have been either cast or new, depending on
the magnetic field, right? with Galileo, we noticed that there were shredding events that happen about every 2 to 3 days. We would have the current sheet would go around. And if you were in the magnetic equatorial plane, then the current sheet would pass over you every 4.5 hours, because Jupiter circulated in 9 hours. So 4.5 hours, you would get your magnetic field would switch as you were sitting there, and the current sheet was going by over you. And in theory, all you had to do was sit there, and every 4.5 hours, you would see the current sheet. You know, like regular, like clockwork. It never happened that way, or it rarely happened that way. It would be going every 4.5 hours, and then there'd be a hiccup, and you'd be going, well, where's the current sheet? It was supposed to be here, you know, several hours ago, and it hasn't shown up yet. And then you'd get 3 or 4 current sheets going by in half an hour. Wait a minute! So it's like your bus schedule. You're waiting for the bus. The bus is supposed to show up at a certain time, and it wasn't showing up. And then 2 or 3 buses would come at once. And for a long time, we could not understand the phenomena that the current sheet wouldn't show up on time, right, like it was circulating in a regular pattern. And so in addition to seeing the interchange mechanism happening, we began to appreciate the fact that in Jupiter, the magnetosphere was shedding itself with plasma about every 2 to 3 days. And we think, but we don't know for sure, that has something to do with how regularly Io, the moon, is loading Jupiter's magnetosphere with plasma from volcanic eruption. So at Saturn, we're just starting to put the picture together, okay? But one of the things that we have is, okay, we see... We're starting to make notes of the plasma sheet. When do we see the plasma sheet in the magnetotail? Do we see it on a regular basis? And it turns out, yeah, we see it on a very regular basis. And here's this. So here's just a drawing of the plasma sheet down the middle, and the spacecraft. The plasma sheet is passing over the spacecraft on regular intervals, as shown by in this diagram. Which is of both magnetometer and MIMI data, and we're seeing the plasma sheet being identified in this data, and it appears regularly. So That's good.
That tells us it's not shedding material like Jupiter.
Well,
is that what it's saying? Or?
The jury is still out. Okay, we're still painting the picture. It's an enormously huge. So one of the things that, if we go to the next slide, here's another picture of MIMI data showing the oscillations of the plasma sheet, oscillations happening all the way from the bow shock and the magnetopause. That's what BS and MP stands for. The outer magnetosphere, the inner magnetosphere, the outer magnetosphere again, and the bow shock and the magnetopause. So we're seeing regular beating of the current sheet going by. And if we go again, we've got rotational modulation in ion fluxes that are measured by the CAPS instrument. And one of the things that is important to note about this figure is that the radial distance in the figure ranges from 48 RS to 12 RS. So they're seeing the plasma sheet, they're seeing regular rotational modulations for a very long distance within Saturn's magnetosphere. But there's the weirdest thing happening. This is not like Jupiter at all. If we go to slide 33, the modulations are not regular. You would expect those modulations to be consistent with the rotation period of at Jupiter. The modulations are based on the rotation period of Jupiter, and then we have superimposed a shedding event going on. So it'll be regular, and then there'll be a hiccup. And at Saturn, what we have is regular, but the period doesn't match the rotation period of Saturn. And the period doesn't match the rotation period that was measured when Voyager was there. And so on page 33, what we're saying is that the IAU, the International Astronomical Union, I think that's what IAU means, the longitude system that's recognized by the international organizations can't be used to organize these rotational modulations that are seen in Saturn's magnetosphere. And the RPWS instrument, which is measuring a certain radio emission called SKR, which is Saturn kilometric radiation, is finding that the SKR drifts in longitude at which it's located and time, and the rate of drift is changing with time. And in the bottom left, there's the peak at the period that was identified by the Voyagers 1 and 2, and then you can see two peaks. One is Cassini's pre-arrival rotation period that was identified with these signals, and the post-arrival rotation period, which is identified with these signals. So what this is a mystery. Okay, what this is something that scientists haven't figured out yet that's going on with Saturn and its and the basic rotation of the magnetosphere. But it's as frustrating for scientists to not be able to pin this down as it would have been, let's say, in the 19th century when people were trying to figure out the latitude. You know, they were trying to measure latitude and, you know, it took quite some time to be able to figure out how to tell what latitude you're at. And here we have, it ought to be a simple matter of being able to measure the planetary rotation rate, and we can't seem to pin it down. And we don't know why it's drifting, and so we have a conundrum and something to explain.
And the Cassini post-arrival period that was measured, was that just for a snapshot, like right after post? Right after Cassini got there?
It's basically something that's still being discussed.
Is it continuing to drift? Or is that
It continues to drift. And they're trying to figure out what sort of period gives you a consistent rotational period. And it's just a conundrum that hasn't been explained yet.
Would it have anything to do with Enceladus?
You know, it's a very interesting question, given that at Jupiter, Io is such a big driver on what happens with the plasma sheet and how it behaves in a macroscopic sense and a microscopic sense. I'm not going to speculate in this forum of whether it has anything to do with Enceladus. At first glance, the densities that Enceladus is putting out would suggest it wouldn't have the same effect as an Io would at Jupiter. There are some other explanations that have been offered that have more to do with I think I'm just going to leave it at that. It's something that is of current interest to magnetospheric physicists looking at the data right now and still trying to figure it out.
Interesting, though.
Okay. So we've looked at some macroscopic issues, like is there a current sheet? Does the current sheet show up on a regular basis? What does that tell us about the basic shape of the current sheet and the shape of Saturn's magnetosphere? Now what I want to go into a little bit is how do we reconstruct what is the basic flow pattern within Saturn's magnetosphere? Excuse me. And one of the things we do is we look in the magnetometer data for perturbations. We also look in the particle instruments for what the distribution functions, and there are several different kinds of distribution functions, what's called pancake distribution functions, butterfly distribution functions. I know in my comet research we have ring distribution functions and other kinds of ways in which particles end up getting distributed in three-dimensional space based on some of the forces that are happening to them. And those forces will also give rise to signatures. If there's a loss mechanism that's present that's causing the particles to be distributed in a certain way, that can also lead to radio signals that give you an earful that tell you something is going on. Okay, I heard, you know, I see the presence of certain kinds of radio emissions, and that tells us that there's some energy exchange going on in this region. So what does the data tell us about that? What I want to do is back up a little bit and talk a little bit about injections and loss mechanisms in a magnetosphere. On page 35, what we have in the lower left is the Earth and the aurora and some day glow. So the sun is off to the left, and you see the sun, the day side, glowing very nicely in both pictures. And you can see the shadow of the sun. There's on the lower right, there's sort of headed off into the corner, is a dark blotch, and that's the Earth's shadow. And the circling the Earth is the lovely aurora on both pictures. And then off to the lower left in the front is plasma, and that is an example of the Earth's plasmasphere being imaged, actually. So we're seeing images of the Earth's plasmasphere. And just to show a diagram of what that looks like, here's the Earth, and right outside of the Earth is the plasmasphere. And outside of that is the radiation belt and the ring current, where we have more energetic particle populations present. Now, just as an aside, some of you may be old enough to remember when they launched the first Geiger counters into space, and that was done at the University of Iowa, actually by Van Allen. And I think they did it, or at least the story I've been told is that it was a lark that they did that, they said, oh, let's see what happens when we put a Geiger counter on a rocket, you know. And they launched it up, and the damn thing started counting, and then it saturated. It counted so many charged particles. And so they said, oh, my God, you know, we've loaded up the Earth with radiation from nuclear explosions, you know. And they didn't realize that the natural environment several Earth radii above in the upper atmosphere includes a large amount of charged particle radiation. So let's go on to the next page. Now, this is, I think, something very cool. Okay, this is from the IMAGE spacecraft. Again, we're imaging the Earth's environment, the charged particle environment of the Earth. And in this picture, again, it's similar to the other one, only the sun is off to the right, and you see that the Earth is in the middle of this green thing, and there's the shadow of the sun, the shadow of the Earth, extending backwards. And we have the plasmasphere that surrounds the Earth, and the ring current behind that in red, and we have what we call an injection event taking place in the as these panels unfold. This blue is represents an injection event, and energetic ring current particles, as part of the Dungey circulation, are being injected forward towards the Earth from the night side, and those are getting injected into the plasmasphere, and gradually plasmaspheric loss happens as the particles precipitate and rain out into the auroral zone. So somebody else had mentioned, do you actually lose particles from the magnetosphere? And you lose particles from the magnetosphere by having them rain out in the auroral zone, and also by having those plasmoids get shot out the back. So again, now in this figure, I know this is a difficult figure to understand, but we have currents coming down into the auroral zone and depositing energy in causing the aurora. And this is what happens during the typical Dungey circulation. That's where you actually have the solar wind connected to the Earth, and you're then circulating particles around and having them get deposited in the auroral zone. And just to give an idea of the amount of power that we're talking about, on the previous page, if we just go back to page 36, a typical substorm is about 150 gigawatts that's depicted in this picture. And I just, I happened to remember during one of our Los Angeles power outages that they talked about how many megawatts was represented by the city of Los Angeles. And I couldn't find that article again, so I went and looked at the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and they said that 280 megawatts is the Los Angeles municipal burden. So somewhere between a typical substorm would represent somewhere between 50 and 100 large cities of the Earth. And so getting back to Saturn, okay, so we showed an image in the IMAGE spacecraft. They're imaging high-energy neutrals, and you see this injection event happening. And so you see a normal image on the left, and then you see an ejection event where you have it brighten up and be red as these energetic particles are being injected, brought towards the Earth into the ring current where they are going to be lost from the plasmasphere.
And that's on 38, right?
I'm sorry?
You're on 38?
On page 38, that's correct. And on Saturn, we have Inca is able to take images of similar kinds of events that resemble injection events. So let's look at the next page. This is on page 39. This is the plasma coming in from the magneto tail of Saturn, and you can see the time going to the right and then down. And so you see this event brightening as plasma is coming in from the magneto tail of Saturn. So this is cool. So we're starting to paint for ourselves the picture of what the circulation, what kind of circulation patterns are happening inside of Saturn. And again, this is a horrible diagram to look at. Plasma being injected into the neutral gas. So Saturn's at the middle. Cassini is noticing hot plasma that's being injected and circulating around Saturn, but being injected into the cooler gas around it, and so they're picking up the signatures of this plasma injection event. So again, we're using the instruments to map out and to create the picture for ourselves of what is happening with the motion of particles through the magnetosphere. So what we've been able to learn so far is that this is basically the same Vassilounis picture that we've looked at several times now already, only it's turned 90 degrees, and the sun is to the bottom, and the big Jupiter magneto disk, or if it was Jupiter, would be going around in this sort of circular center. And we talked about where it resembled the Earth in terms of the X line being formed. And in this, where it says A, this would be where Jupiter has injections that are happening, like at the Earth. And then at B is where it's shredding, and the plasma is going down the downtail by way of either the interchange mechanism or by other mechanisms of plasmaspheric shredding. And so this basic circulation pattern has not, with the injections in that same kind of region, has not been shown to be true for Saturn. And what we have noticed are three dipolarization events where, if in the Dungey-type circulation, where you have the X line that forms, when that X line moves down the tail and the plasmoid shoots off towards the moon, then the magnetic field lines that shoot back towards the Earth go from being all stretched out because they formed an X line to being back towards being more dipolar. And that's called a dipolarization event. And it's associated with plasma injection. Plasma is being, when the magnetic field becomes dipolarized again, the plasma that's on those field lines gets shot forward towards the Earth. And so all we can say so far is that we've noticed some dipolarization events happening at Saturn, and these are the dates that have been given. And two of them have been noted to be corresponding with the northward turning of the interplanetary magnetic field, which suggests that that would be a strong indication that Dungey circulation is at work at Saturn. So what that means is that, like Jupiter, the angular momentum seems to play a role, but like Earth, there may be significant changes that are introduced by the presence of circulation pattern that where the solar wind and Saturn have become connected, and we're circulating solar wind through Saturn's magnetosphere. And so now it's time to look at my cool movie. And what this is a simulation. This is, again, not real data, but it's where we've modeled what we think might be happening at Jupiter. And here's where we do think that plasma loading in near Enceladus, okay, is causing something to happen, is causing Saturn to shed itself of plasma. But it's happening in a slightly different way than it does at Jupiter. And the shredding in this simulation is shown to happen on the dawn side instead of the dusk side. So if we press the go button, on my presentation in the lower left corner, there's a little film strip that if you just press the film strip, then the movie will play. And I have to, it looks like, press the go button on the left to make it play. And as mine is running, I'm just going to run this a couple of times. You can see that the green is plasma that is, it circulates around Saturn for, it looks like, several rotations, and then it just, it's like it belches a big plasmoid off on the dawn side, and it goes off down the tail.
And that's the Enceladus material?
Well, if we have time, and I'm not sure if I didn't just decide to save that material for another presentation, but we have this big neutral cloud in the middle of Saturn. And the neutral cloud is no doubt, my opinion, this is my opinion, it's not only Enceladus material, but it's space weathering of all the icy satellites. So it's probably no accident that the neutral cloud encompasses all the icy satellites. So it's not just coming from Enceladus, but I believe that there's probably a process in which neutral oxygen and other water products, water family products, are being released from the surfaces of the icy planets, icy moons, and that that material is loading, it gets charge exchanged and eventually loads the magnetosphere of Saturn, and then Saturn is shedding itself of some of that excess material. And that's just me speculating. We still have a long way to go to prove to ourselves that those are the things that are happening at Saturn.
And just to ask a question to clarify what you were saying on a previous slide, in one of these shedding events, did you say that associated with it is an ejection event? Event as sort of the steel lines kind of bounce back?
Yes. If we go back to page 41, and there's an A and a B region that are outlined on this diagram, and in the A diagram, part of the diagram is where this injection. This would be for Jupiter, okay? Where the injection is happening, that's like with a terrestrial substorm system, and in the B region, the material is being shed down the tail. So, if we go, yes.
Okay. Well, but then you had, okay, on page 40, you had said, okay, that Mimi has detected an injection event.
Right.
Okay, so that would be the A part.
Page 39. Right.
And the B part is what we're watching in the movie.
Yes. While this picture on page 41, we have a picture that's appropriate for Jupiter. We're trying to paint the picture for ourselves for Saturn. So the regions don't connect up directly yet. Okay, we don't know. We're not sure. We haven't figured out how the circulation pattern works exactly yet. But we've got data like those injection events, and we're in the process of understanding how this picture fits together.
Right.
Okay. So let's go to page 43 now and just talk a little bit in summary. Is there a magneto tail at Jupiter? Officially, the jury is still out. We've said that in order for there to be a magneto tail, there has to be a current sheet present and carrying currents. We think, I showed you the data that shows the measurements of oscillations and the presence of a current sheet. Does Saturn have substorms like the Earth? Again, the jury is still out. We have measured these injection events. I showed you that data, and they look very similar to injection events at the Earth, but in order to really complete the picture, you have to understand the complete circulation pattern and where these particles are coming and going, and we haven't gotten those kinds of mapping pinned down yet. Is there a dayside current sheet that interacts with the aurora? Yes. There has been a paper written that showed that there are currents that connect the dayside current sheet with the aurora. Is there a hinged tail current sheet? It appears that at Saturn, the current sheet bends. It's not just a complete flat disk, but someplace out, at past 16 RS, there's a kink in it, and it bends, and that's to adjust for angular momentum. And are we seeing X lines like the Vasilinus picture tells us that there are at Jupiter, and which we were eventually able to sort of understand how that pattern worked at Jupiter, and the jury is still out in terms of where the X lines are, where they exist, and how the shedding pattern work. So So I had this previous slide that says what constitutes a magnetotail, and we said an asymmetrical cavity is not a magnetotail. And we said that at Earth, we have the solar wind interaction in the Dungey-style circulation. At Jupiter, the magnetotail is formed pretty much by a planetary wind of stuff going down. At Saturn, no consensus yet, though quite clearly a central current sheet is present. And so in some respects, understanding how this circulation pattern works and how the magnetotail is formed is going to depend on understanding how much flux goes over the poles. So finally, from what we've been able to get from the data so far, I think this is one of the coolest pictures that we've put together of a magnetosphere. We have this sort of bowl-shaped plasma disk. And that's why the magnetosphere sort of turns up on the left on this picture on page 45. The solar wind enters and goes around, but we think it probably recirculates towards the pole in some way that we haven't quite figured out yet. On this particular diagram, it shows an X line. So the artist was confident that an X line would appear in this picture, and it doesn't quite show the central neutral cloud in this one. Maybe I have it on the next one. Yeah, okay, so this is another picture of Saturn's magnetosphere. We do these when we get the data and we start doing our cutaways and comparing it to what there is at the Earth. And like at the Earth, here, the energetic neutral atom, ENAs, are shown. The solar wind is shown going around, going into the tail, but also entering the cusp, creating auroral AKR. We have Titan interactions shown here. We have hot plasma being depicted. All of these things are, you know, pictures of the magnetosphere that is really still in the process of being assembled as we try to interpret all of the data that we've gathered with these instruments and paint a picture for ourselves of something that's invisible, that we can't really see, but we have to use our other senses to figure out how it works. So that concludes my talk.
Well, thank you very much. That was really interesting. I've sort of been asking questions throughout, but do people have questions that they want to jump in at this point?
Could I ask one about the last slide, please? David Lockett speaking. There is a further energetic neutral cloud associated with the Titan orbit from the diagram. Could you say something about that?
I didn't spend any time really talking about the Titan measurements. And I have to admit that I am not familiar with that particular ENA measurement that's shown on this diagram.
Now,
I do know. I'm sorry?
Well, I was just. We see a Titan neutral torus on there. Oh,
yeah.
ENA's, okay, right there in yellow. Okay, right next, right at Titan.
Right. I mean, I know that there have been ENA measurements at Titan, and I apologize for not being familiar enough with those measurements to be able to tell you exactly what's being depicted in this diagram on that.
Okay, thanks.
But the other ENAs that you show in there, closer in, are those? So there's the ENAs that are close in, but it looks like it's still outside of the rings. And then there's the satellites and ring neutrals.
Right.
Farther out, which are different from the ENA.
Right.
Okay.
I think one of the reasons, I mean, we, in order to be able to get these ENAs imaged, they have to actually go up in latitude to be able to be above the equatorial plane to see them. And we haven't done that very often. So I know that Mimi's always complaining about wanting to have more opportunities to do inky imaging of the ENAs. So I think again those are measurements that we still need to make in order to understand the picture of what's going on that the ENAs can tell us.
an evolving picture. This is not the
right.
Final, not the final picture.
Me again, David Lightfoot. Can you define hot in terms of hot plasma? Is this hot in terms of degrees Kelvin, or is it hot meaning a euphemism for high energy? What is
that
hot?
It's a euphemism for high energy.
Right.
And so you're talking about MeV particles when you're talking hot. And the temperature would be in 10,000 degrees or some ludicrous, you know, we can't even imagine. And then the density is so small that, if you talk to a little kid and you said, it's really hot, it's 10,000 degrees, and you think, oh, I'm going to fry out there. Well, no, because the particle's energetic, but we're talking about particles of a density of like 5 per square centimeter or something. So it doesn't convey that kind of temperature as if it was a force. Do you know what I mean?
Yep, understood.
Any other questions at this point?
Question, please.
Yes.
Would it be possible to check for long-term magnetic field changes, comparing data from the Voyager flybys with the Cassini data?
Yes, the investigators are busy doing that as we speak, pouring through the Voyager data and looking for the changes between then and now.
Fortunately,
you know, to me, it's fortunate. There's no easy answers for how the magnetosphere has changed in that time. And we really have to sort of go back to the drawing board and try to understand the physics of what's going on in that region. I mean, right now, what's happening in terms of trying to understand is fascinating. And I don't want to speculate in public when people are trying to sort of figure things out and there are papers and discussions going back and forth on what the mechanisms might be. And when they're finally get it figured out enough to publish it, then we can really talk about it. But it's just fascinating to listen to some of the ideas for what might be at work in this environment. And hopefully, you know, in another year, we may be able to have another CHARM conference where we'll lay some of those ideas out for you and talk about how it works.
Could I ask one more question, please?
Yes.
I noticed on the diagram for the Earth, it shows the interior ring current going from east to west.
Yes.
And since Jupiter and Saturn's polarity are reversed to the Earth, would the ring currents on those planets be going in the opposite direction?
That's correct.
Would that have any effect on the way the particles are entering the planets themselves?
What happens is that, yes, the answer is yes, it does. And at Earth, when the interplanetary magnetic field turns southward, that's when it's able to connect with and actually become connected to the Earth's magnetic field, and you have the Sun and Earth connected. On Saturn and Jupiter, it's the opposite. When you have northward-turning magnetic field, that's when you have that situation. So, yes, the opposite polarity of the magnetic field does introduce some wrinkles on how the circulation pattern works compared to how it works at the Earth.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I have a question about the moon.
Yes?
The image, we're looking down on the North Pole Saturn there.
Which the very last page?
No, the movie.
Oh, the movie.
Yeah.
Yes, we're looking down on the North Pole of Saturn.
My image, I got 6 little orange dots.
Yes, I'm not exactly sure what that is.
Okay.
Those are not Saturn's moons, however.
Right.
Let me play that and see if I think that's just an artifact of the movie. Yeah, you know what? I'm going to have to ask the fellow who puts this together what those 6 little dots are. I think that's Well, I don't know. It's some sort of marker, either like the round ring, I think, is Titan's orbit. But I'm not sure why there are six little dots there.
Any further questions? Well, maybe we'll let Dr. Alexander go and get some dinner.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for the interesting talk. That was really great. And I hope that everybody can join us for the next Charm Telecom, which is going to be on April 24th. And in that one, we will have a presentation about Enceladus. So thank you very much, everybody. And we will talk to you next time.
Okay, thanks, everybody. It was a pleasure being here with you.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.